Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I am in Chapel Hill, North Carolina today, home to the University of North Carolina's flagship campus, where researchers are trying to get a better understanding of the causes and treatments of autism. Autism is a developmental disorder that affects communication and behavior, and one in every 60 kids is diagnosed with it. In addition to genetic causes, which we'll talk about, there are also environmental factors that increase a child's risk of developing autism, including maternal health and prenatal exposure to air pollution. But currently, there is no cure. The federal government has kicked in millions of dollars for research right here at UNC, and two of the researchers join us now. Mark Zilka, professor of cell biology and physiology. Welcome to you.
Welcome.
And Joe Piven is a professor of psychiatry and pediatrics. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
So let's start with just the basics here of autism. How would you define autism? We often say people are on the spectrum, but what is it a spectrum of, Joe?
Well, it's defined by a co-occurrence of certain behaviors. So we don't have an X-ray or a blood test. And the behaviors in question are in the realm of social behavior, so a certain kind of social deficit, and what we call ritualistic repetitive stereotype behavior. So a child that has those, that's when we diagnose autism.
And how long have we been diagnosing people with autism?
Well, it was first described in the 1940s, but it was very slow going until really the last 20 years. And we've had just enormous interest that's generated by the evidence that the prevalence seems to be rising, and that's generated a lot of enthusiasm in funding agencies researchers.
And do you believe that the prevalence is rising of autism now?
Well, the prevalence is higher than it was 20 years ago. The question is what is causing that. I think it's a combination of things, much of which may be just our better recognition and widening criteria. But also we have some ideas about environmental factors as well.
We know that genetics and environment both contribute to autism. And I'd say there's been a real revolution in the past 10 years in terms of our understanding of the genetic basis for autism. And this revolution has really been sparked by the rapidly reducing cost of sequencing human genomes. And they've turned up now over 100 genes and gene mutations that are linked to autism.
So let's get to some of your research. And Joe, your research involves using brain imaging to try to detect infants who are at high risk of developing autism later on. What looks different in the brain of someone who's going to develop autism versus someone who isn't?
Right. Well, that in and of itself is one of the most exciting findings, I think, in the field. The fact that babies who are at high familial risk, they have an older sibling with autism, who go on to develop autism by 24 or 36 months, they don't look like they have autism in the first year of life. And that's really quite amazing. And that window gives us an opportunity to think about early detection, if we can detect them, and early intervention. In our studies of the brain, what we realized was that the brain looks different in those kids that go on to develop autism as early as 6 months of age. And so we used that information to develop a test to predict who's at ultra high risk. So we have several studies now that have shown that we can predict 8 out of 10 kids that will in this high familial risk group that will go on to meet criteria for autism. Now, the exact abnormality I can't point to. This is sort of a very statistical approach, but it has to do with surface anatomy, surface area. The convolutions on the surface of the brain is one approach, and another has to do with functional networks in the brain.
So if you know that somebody is going to develop autism, or if you have a pretty good confidence that that's going to happen, what's the next step?
Right. Well, that's a wide open question. We haven't been able to identify these children in infancy before, and so we have no idea of what the treatment should be. And I think I also want to point out that we're not treating autism. We're treating children that look like they're developing typically. But as a rule of thumb in medicine, we treat things before they happen. So we are interested in high blood pressure because it leads to stroke. So we treat high blood pressure. And so that's a well-worn path. And we believe that earlier is better.
How difficult is it for you to get the subjects for this research?
It has been harder than we'd expect. I mean, I guess it's not surprising. You already have a family with a child with autism, so that's, you know, creates a certain amount of burden. You have a newborn. It's a challenge, but we think this has extraordinary potential in really focusing interventions on this period before kids get autism. It's if you search for www.ibis-network.org, that will lead you to our study. It's the infant brain imaging study about autism and recruitment.
Mark, let's talk about your work for a moment. You're trying to use gene editing to cure Angelman's, which is a genetic condition linked to autism.
Yep. So Angelman syndrome is a rare neurodevelopmental disorder. These are children that are largely nonverbal. They have motor problems, so it's severely disabling. The disorder is due to a mutation in a single gene. It's a gene called UBE3A. And as some of your listeners may know, we inherit half of our genes from our mom, mm-hmm. the other half from our dads. Usually we essentially have a backup copy of every gene. But in the case of this disorder, only the mom's copy is expressed in the brain. The dad's copy is turned off. And so this is fine in most individuals, but in an individual with Angelman, the mom's copy is mutated. So they effectively have no UBE3A in their brain. And so what our work is doing is trying to take advantage of that dormant father's copy of the gene. It's functional but turned off. And so using these new genome editing technologies like CRISPR-Cas9, we're going in and trying to turn on that dad's copy of the gene. CRISPR-Cas9 is all the rage. It was only identified several years ago, but there are already treatments that are going into humans. So I think this is a technology that really has a lot of benefit, especially for neurodevelopmental disorders.
Are there concerns about the fact that it is gene editing? There was somebody in China who was gene editing, and it became a big controversy.
Right. So you want to try and avoid getting CRISPR-Cas into the germ cells because you don't want to pass any mutations or that you generate to future generations. The advantage of a neurodevelopmental disorder is that we're trying to fix things in the brain. And so we can restrict these gene therapies to the brain, basically provide a beneficial effect without some of the side effects that people are often talking about.
And you've been able to essentially cure Angelman's in mice?
I wouldn't use the word cure, but yeah, Angelman's in mice, there are a number of symptoms that we've been able to treat. Yes, we can't treat all of them. And this gets to the question of when do you treat these neurodevelopmental disorders? Obviously, if you have a child with Angelman syndrome, you would like some treatment for that individual. But the latest data really points to earlier interventions being better, to the point where prenatal treatment is probably going to be more beneficial than treating later. And I mean, that makes sense. If you have a disorder that's affecting how the brain forms, if you have too many neurons or too few neurons, you can't go back and change that after the brain's been built. And so the idea is to develop gene therapies that can get in early to fix these genetic problems.
Do you think that this could open the doors to treatment of autism more broadly?
I do. So we know that a lot of these autism genes have been identified. So that makes it possible to start tinkering with some of these other genes. So I mentioned UBE3A for Angelman syndrome, but we now have a list of over 100 genes that are linked to autism risk. CRISPR-Cas technology can be used to turn genes off or turn genes on. And so since many cases of autism are due to loss of one copy, you still have a second copy that is functional. And so you could use an editing approach to turn on the functional copy to a higher level.
Do you come across the argument from people who say, I don't need to be cured of this condition?
Yep. So I think that's something we commonly hear. But I like to counter that everybody wants the best for their baby. You know, if you have a baby and at birth they have some problem that surgery can correct, people are not going to neglect the surgery to fix the baby. We know that there are certain genes that can cause autism. The manifestation of the symptoms tend to be around 2 years of age. But with genetics, we can actually pick these mutations up early. So early diagnosis is one arm of this, but the other is treatment. And so we think with gene therapies, gene editing approaches could be used to treat early.
Let me just ask you finally, both of you, why you have decided to devote your career right now to the study of autism. Joe.
Well, I wish it was a very clear response that I could give you. I think it's just sort of incremental steps in my career. But I can say that it's extraordinarily interesting, and we are at an age where the science, I think, can finally have an impact. So it's only gotten more and more exciting, and it's very rewarding work.
Mark?
Yeah, in my case, I've gone to several Angelman syndrome conferences. And at these conferences, since it's a rare disorder, the parents come with their children. So this is an opportunity for the scientists to meet the parents, find out what the concerns are. But in talking with the parents, you realize that, you know, they really are relying on us to be the ones who come up with the next treatments for their children. And so it's very rewarding to be able to interact with the families and see that the work that we're doing in the lab is going to have real-world benefits to those families and individuals with Angelman syndrome.
Let me ask you one more thing, which is you're getting funding from the National Institutes of Health. How vital is that funding from taxpayers for your research?
I mean, we couldn't do it without that funding. You know, the study that we're doing now is at five clinical sites around the country. We've been at this for over 10 years. We're going to be going with this particular study another 5 years. So it's extraordinarily expensive. And I think there are some wonderful advocacy and private funding agencies as well that complement that. But the NIH is really kind of the mainstay.
Yep, I would second that. There's no way we'd be able to do this research without the support of the NIH.
That is Mark Zilka and Joe Piven from the University of North Carolina's School of Medicine. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a big thanks to our friends at member station WUNC here in Chapel Hill for hosting us the last couple of days.